Welcome to another episode of the Oncology On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Ariana Pelosi. Following an exciting ASCO GI, Rena Lokaj, assistant editor at Cancer Network, spoke with Jun Gong and Denang Lee regarding the presentations they felt were most impactful.
So welcome to our live podcast recapping the trials in GI cancers from the recent 2024 ASCO GI meeting. My name is Rena Lokaj, and I'm an assistant editor with Cancer Network, home of the journal Oncology. Today, we will be discussing these important trials and how the results can be implemented into clinical practice with our guests, Dr. Gong and Dr. Lee. Dr. Gong is a medical oncologist who specializes in the treatment of GI cancers at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, and he's joined by Dr. Lee, an associate professor in the Department of Medical Oncology and Therapeutics Research at City of Hope. If you have any questions, feel free to comment below or request to speak. You can find the request button beneath the microphone, and we'll hold at the end for additional questions. So, whenever you guys are ready.
All right. Thank you so much, Cancer Network, for having Dr. Lee and myself join in on this ASCO GI recap. Dr. Lee, how are you doing?
Good, Dr. Gong. So I think there's, you know, certainly been a lot of exciting stuff that was presented this past week at GI ASCO. So really honored and happy to recap some of the, you know, key studies from GI ASCO and provide our thoughts today.
Yes, completely agree. There was a lot of exciting data, potentially practice changing. There were several from colorectal cancer, as well as some from HCC and neuroendocrine tumors that I wanted to talk about. Did you perhaps want to go over firstly what you thought were some of the more impactful or interesting studies that caught your eye at GI ASCO?
Yeah, sure. So maybe I think I can start, and I'll pick one study from neuroendocrine tumors and one study in terms of HCC, and then, you know, I think I'll then hopefully have you highlight, you know, some of the colorectal key trials, you know, from that. So to start off, you know, I think one of the most pivotal studies that was presented this past week at GI ASCO was the NETTER-2 phase 3 clinical trial with lutetium-177 dotatate as a first-line treatment option for patients that had higher grade 2 or grade 3 gastroenteropancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. So really to kind of set the stage for this was, you know, previously lutetium-177 dotatate has been now established as a really a second line or second line plus treatment for our patients with gastroenteropancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, really based off of the initial NETTER-1 trial in midgut neuroendocrine tumors, as well as the Erasmus experience. So that led to in that trial, when patients that had progressive midgut neuroendocrine tumors and when they received lutetium-177 dotatate versus high-dose octreotide LAR at 60 milligrams every 28 days showed that the lutetium-177 dotatate led to significant progression-free survival advantage and ultimately leading to FDA approval. So the idea is, you know, can we essentially move from further lines of therapy before in the advanced setting now to kind of earlier setting, particularly for those patients that have more aggressive disease. So those that are higher grade 2 tumors or even well-differentiated grade 3 gastroenteropancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. So this really set the stage for the NETTER-2 trial, which now randomized lutetium-177 dotatate plus maintenance octreotide 30 milligrams LAR versus high-dose octreotide LAR 60 milligrams again in this patient population. And I think the results were, I would say, very consistent with what we probably anticipated. So if you compare the NETTER-2 results, the arm that received lutetium-177 dotatate had a median PFS of 22.8 months, and those that got the high-dose octreotide had a median PFS of 8.5 months, resulting in a hazard ratio of 0.276. This is very similar to the hazard ratio that you saw from the original NETTER-1 study in a further line treatment type of trial, now in a first-line treatment trial here with the NETTER-2 study. So Very consistent PFS advantage. I think what was a little bit surprising is that if we think that this treatment is ultimately going to really help our patients, is would this necessarily translate into overall survival benefit, which is always very hard for neuroendocrine tumor trials because of the fact that traditionally they're more slow-growing types of tumors, but you're now selecting for a more aggressive type of biology and neuroendocrine tumors. So that's one of the questions I think is really being raised. And then the other question is that the investigators also presented some quality of life data, and at least time to deterioration in terms of quality of life was actually similar between the arms. So even though lutetium-177 DOTATATE used in the first-line setting in this more aggressive biology population, it didn't necessarily lead to a time to deterioration for quality of life. So this really kind of speaks to, kind of how would this ultimately impact our sequence of treatment. So from my perspective, it's really that, I think in a certain case, you can consider this, especially patients where you're looking for significant tumor shrinkage, because the authors were able to show a very high objective response rate of over 40% with this population. But, would we use this in terms of all comers, especially, some of the grade 2 neuroendocrine tumors, even with higher Ki-67? I don't think that's yet to be determined, and it's, somewhat of a selective process.
Thanks for that recap, Dr. Lee. Did you see anything concerning about the rate of secondary hematologic malignancies, or were you kind of reassured from this at such an early stage of treatment with lutetium?
Yeah, it was very low. I think what they reported was, less than 1%, certainly, but I don't think there has been, enough follow-up, for this. And I think we'll have to continue to follow this going forward, because that is the main concerning toxicity with this type of treatment.
But exciting data, as you mentioned, something really for this grade 3, well-differentiated population that could sometimes have very unpredictable courses. And it's great to see your insight about assessing maybe who could benefit from, not all comers may need it, your grade 2s, maybe those who have more rapid pace of bulky disease, for example. So thank you for that excellent insight on NETTER.
Yeah, sure. So kind of shifting gears, I would say the next study to highlight is really the EMERALD one trial, which is a phase 3 study that was randomized and placebo-controlled of essentially TACE, either TACE by itself or combined with durvalumab, which is a PD-L1 inhibitor, and with or without bevacizumab in patients with unresectable HCC eligible for embolization. So, this is really kind of potentially taking the idea that now that we have better systemic therapies in the advanced setting, how can we move this to really kind of an intermediate stage setting? So those patients that really have liver confined disease, and would it potentially improve outcomes? So as I mentioned, this was a global randomized double blind placebo controlled trial where essentially patients got in arm A, the durvalumab plus TACE. In arm B, they got the durvalumab plus bevacizumab plus TACE. And then in arm C, they essentially just got TACE. And the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. This was a very well-conducted study because the blinding was maintained throughout the treatment period, including the initial period where patients were undergoing TACE. So it wasn't like the investigators knew what the patients were getting at that time point and could, slow down the number of TACE that they did. So the investigators really were able to, control this. And the primary finding from this trial was that median PFS definitely improved in the arm of patients that got TACE plus durvalumab plus bevacizumab compared to TACE plus placebo. So TACE plus placebo had a median PFS of 8.2 months, whereas those that got TACE plus durvalumab plus bevacizumab had a median PFS of 15 months. Objective response rate also improved from 29.6% in the taste plus placebo arm to those that got either taste plus durvalumab by itself or taste plus durvalumab plus bevacizumab above 40% respectively. So this was technically a positive trial, but I think in the context of everything, the idea is that there's a lot of questions. One of the things that we know for the intermediate group of HSC patients is that this is a very heterogeneous group. Is this liver-confined disease that's bilobar? You know, how many lesions are there within the liver? How large is the largest tumor? Are there any, side portal, vascular invasion? And we didn't necessarily get as much details about this, from the trial. So I think one of the things to really look out for in the future is, can we have some of those, subgroup analyses to really define which are the patient population that we're going to, benefit the most from this type of treatment? Because at the end of the day, while this led to improvement in median PFS, I think all of us suspect that it's unlikely that it's going to necessarily translate to OS, given that the initial interim analysis didn't show a difference in OS. So this becomes the question of, do you essentially combine everything upfront, or do you essentially, do this in a sequential manner in terms of doing liver-directed therapy and then followed by systemic therapy, and whether or not that's a difference or not. So a lot of questions, I think, remain, but certainly the investigator should be commended for doing this study, because I think this is the first time we're really going to have this data of all of these patients that have very, heterogeneous presentations. And that I think we should take advantage of that data to really be able to learn from this, given the positive findings that are being shown here in EMERALD-1.
Certainly a lot of points to digest here with this study, a very exciting study. Dr. Lee, at your institution, do you do more TACE or TERI with Y90, for example, in some of these intermediate stage HCC subjects? Because that's also been a point of contention, whether TACE is the appropriate comparator in this setting.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Dr. Gon. So at our site, we actually use both. It's kind of depending on the patient presentation. But I will say that I think we are, trending more, and we tend to use more TARE or Y90 right now, just because of, some of the potential effects on the patients. A lot of times patients can actually recover much quicker from that, and can you get maybe a little bit better control of the disease. So we're definitely more TARE compared to TACE, but we still use TACE in certain, patients that we see.
We're kind of the same. We use a little bit of both. It was interesting to see, just talking this out, that in terms of the heterogeneity comment that you mentioned, they included about 20% of BCLC stage C patients in there, and so there was some patients with portal vein involvement too, and that could be debated whether TACE, was an appropriate treatment in that setting as well.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think like I mentioned, I think diving a little bit deeper into the subsets are going to be really important. Like, usually we think that subsets are really more kind of hypothesis generating. But I think in this particular study and the population that you're going to look at, I think that's going to be actually very informative and very important in terms of what we think is the best for our patients.
It was nice to have kind of Western representation in a phase 3 setting of this nature. So that was really great. And Dr. Lee, you may remember the SPACE trial a couple of years ago that was sorafenib plus TACE, which was negative. So I think in speaking to some of our colleagues, including yourself, there was already some extrapolation into the, how could we, if this does get routinely implemented, is it that just VEGF blockade is not enough, but that immunotherapy plus TACE is not enough as well, and that VEGF plus IO combination is what, generated the signal with TACE over TACE alone. And then naturally, atezo-bev is already approved. Could we extrapolate that combination in combination with local regional therapy? So there's a lot of questions, like you said, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on any of those comments.
Yeah, I think a lot of, you know, academic centers, this type of strategy, we've already kind of been doing it and everything. You know, for patients that might have residual disease after, you know, treatment with liver-directed therapy, we might be already, you know, starting systemic therapy relatively early. Like you said, with the indication for atezolizumab plus bevacizumab for unresectable HCC patients. So, you know, I think what's reassuring is that Emerald really reemphasizes that. And I do think that, you know, in the community, this is going to, you know, certainly reassure the community much more in terms of how to use kind of multidisciplinary care in the treatment of our HCC patients.
Got it. So thank you again. And for the purposes of time, I guess we should move on to colorectal.
Yeah. So yeah. I know this is, you know, in your area much more and everything. So, you know, one of the studies that was presented with was the CheckMate 8 HW study. You know, can you highlight some of the important points that you saw from that study?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually thought this was one of the more exciting studies and should have. I was surprised it could have made it to the oral abstract plenaries, but I think the late breaking abstract was quite late, and so they still made it into the rapid abstract session, because this was, you know, a comparator in a way to the KEYNOTE-177, which led to pembrolizumab being established as the first line standard for MSI high mCRC, and here CheckMate 8HW compared nivolumab and ipilimumab at the standard 240 milligram dosing with nivo and the lower dose of 1 mg per kg every 3 weeks for ipi times 4 doses, followed by essentially nivo 480 every 4 weeks. And it was essentially compared to also a monotherapy arm, which wasn't really reported out yet, but the control arm was the investigator's choice of FOLFOX or FOLFIRI combined with a biologic. In the first line setting, it was a 2-to-2-to-1 randomization. And essentially, in, like I said, first line MCRC, that is MSI high. Straight off the bat, it was positive for the primary endpoint, progression-free survival. It was a nice separation of the curves, as you may have seen, Dr. Lee. The 24-month PFS rate was about 72% in the nivo ipi arm and 14% in the comparator, control arm. And this was overall not reached in terms of the overall median PFS. And the nice thing about this was the curves really didn't cross like they did in KEYNOTE-177 early on. They really kind of stayed together, never crossed, and then separated. And that separation was huge. And so this already kind of hints at, you know, there's always been a question that maybe is a bit more active than the refractory MI MCRC trials, where you saw nivo ipi's overall response rates were really monotherapy. And so you wonder, is this playing out as well with this superior PFS benefit? The overall survival is a co-secondary endpoint, is not reported out yet. I think the takeaway from this is that it's exciting, and this really solidifies that we shouldn't be using chemotherapy as a first-line standard in MSI-high MCRC. This is where a non-chemo option is standard of care first-line. Does the CheckMate 8HW combination become the new standard of care? I think we have to be a little bit careful here, because if you look at the toxicities, we know that the toxicity profile of the combination has always been a little higher than the doublet. And what was notable was that there were two actually treatment-related AEs of death in the combination arm. And although this is an initial presentation of the data, that really raises some concern of whether this should be applied to all comers. So I think the takeaway is that it is an alternative option as a new standard of care. It certainly should be IO, but I think we still have to sort out and get some granularity of who could benefit from a monotherapy pembro approach versus a doublet nivo-ipi approach.
Absolutely. I think that's a great summary. And I think that's always the challenge when, you know, we add, you know, CTLA-4 and everything, you know, the concern about additional toxicity. So I think we have to weigh, you know, how much additional benefit are we getting with that CTLA-4 over single agent, you know, therapy, and is that worth it? And is there, you know, different populations that might require different strategies in that sense? So, you know, for the sake of time, you know, I think we'll move on to the next study. So you know, one of the other interesting studies that I got presented was this bespoke study. Do you want to comment on that study?
Sure. And I think it was, I was hoping, Dr. Lee, if maybe I can kind of condense the bespoke and the Galaxy data.
They were
both talking about ctDNA, which was exciting. There was a negative trial of ctDNA in COBRA, but I think it was reassuring to see that the tumor-informed assay studies, Bespoke and Galaxy, really presented some updated, promising results. The difference, you know, Bespoke was really, it's a multi-center, but really localized to the U.S. Kind of study, and investigating a stage 2 to 3 population post-operatively, while Galaxy was really a global study, and it actually included stage 1 through 4, and as a result, it really had a larger data set of nearly 3,000 subjects enrolled versus the 200 or so in Bespoke. But some commonalities in both studies, they really found a powerful signal that if you were ctDNA positive in the MRD assessment window, this always was associated with an inferior DFS, disease-free survival, across all stages almost, compared to those who were ctDNA negative. But I think that was reassuring to kind of have this you know, representation and confirmation. But I think they offered some new data too that was a little bit interesting, in that in the Galaxy trial, they had this concept of transient clearance, where if you had a clearance but then ultimately returned positive ctDNA, they presented some interesting data that by 18 months, those who had transient clearance, 98% of those had returned positive by 18 months. And then they also presented another interesting landmark that in the 6-month window, if you're receiving adjuvant chemotherapy, if you had a greater 50% or so decrease in ctDNA levels, this was associated with a better DFS than those who did not have a 50% decrease. So I thought it was really great to have some landmarks here of 18 months and 6 months that could really inform future studies about these kind of landmark settings for ctDNA-guided studies. The other things I just wanted to comment about was Bespoke presented some novel data by Dr. Cassie as well, that the in the subset of patients that actually had became MRD positive and were oligometastatic, this ctDNA was associated with oligometastatic directed therapies in about 40% of cases. So it was nice to see that data set. And then also, Dr. Cassie presented some very, very interesting data on quality of life with patient perspectives, where actually about over 90% of patients found value in ctDNA MRD monitoring, and 90% would want to continue monitoring their ctDNA, and actually 70%+ showed that they actually relieved some patient anxiety but by having this information available. So I thought those were the key kind of takeaways from these two large studies on ctDNA in colorectal cancer.
No, yeah, I think it's really interesting. You know, ctDNA continues to evolve, and I think the anxiety findings I found very surprising and very intriguing. So I think, you know, more to look at this in the future. And then finally, you know, there was, you know, some updates, you know, for the phase 3 FRESCO-2 trial. Can you comment about that study?
Yes. So this was a more of a, also a quality of life kind of study. This was actually a post-hoc analysis of the FRESCO-2 trial. As a brief reminder, FRESCO-2 was a refractory MCRC global study that showed the superiority of fruquintinib in patients that were heavily pretreated, median 3 lines of therapy versus placebo, and essentially conferred an OS benefit of about 2.6 months over placebo, and actually leading to its FDA approval not too long ago in the past couple of months as a treatment refractory option in MCRC, unselected MCRC. This study essentially used a Q-twist analysis, and I am not a Q-twist expert or a quality of life or a statistician expert, but my understanding is that the Q-twist analysis really weighs into your time on treatment and balances that with quality-adjusted toxicity and symptoms as well. So really weighing how much time you're on treatment with these kind of adverse events. And what it really showed was that the Q-twist for the fruquintinib arm was 6.25 months, and it was higher than that of placebo for 4.21 months. And that there was also, in terms of the difference in the Q-twist, it was felt that it was mainly driven by the toxicity assessments of this compound. So I think in a way this study really presented reassuring data, and that it kind of is consistent with the tolerability that we've seen in the clinic with fruquintinib. It's a VEGF inhibitor, but doesn't really cause much, in my opinion, severe toxicities. And I think this is playing out in the quality of life analysis too, that patients are experiencing some quality of life benefit from fruquintinib compared to placebo as well.
Yeah, wonderful. I love the different new ways that we're analyzing quality of life in our patients, because I think that's certainly very important and is coming to the forefront now. So I think with that, we'll now open up the floor to any questions. As a reminder, you can comment below or request to speak. The request button is located underneath the microphone.
And while that's happening, I'll just ask a question here. So, fruquintinib was approved in November of 2023. Have either of you had a chance to implement this into your practice?
So I can speak for myself. Yes, we have used it on several patients already. And so far, it's playing out really the way it has been in terms of safety. I think it's really tolerable. It's still quite early in these patients. It was only approved. And so a lot of them, the first interval assessment scans have yet to be played out. But this is something that we're rapidly using in the clinic. What about you, Dr. Lee?
Yeah, we used it on a few patients, and I agree with you. I think it's still relatively early to kind of, get this, real world experience and everything. I think, more to learn over time.
Great. And then I just have another question. Can you guys talk a little bit about ctDNA in the space of GI cancers?
Dr. Lee, we kind of talked about it in CRC. Do you use it in any of the other GI types, GI cancer types?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it's, starting to move in terms of other diseases and everything. But I just don't know, certainly whether or not we're there yet. Just because I do think, potentially with different types of GI malignancies, that there are, somewhat differences in that setting. So I would say not there yet, but certainly an area of research that, different individuals are focusing on.
And I would agree to that. I think there's growing data and some nice studies coming out with gastric cancer and pancreatic cancer as well. So I agree though, a little early, but we're eagerly awaiting how these results pan out as well.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for joining. This was a really great way to recap ASCO GI. And for everyone to continue to receive updates on the latest coverage in cancer care, be sure to visit our website, cancernetwork.com, and follow us on our social media. So thank you guys again.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care, everyone. Bye.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.